Yasha Koach. You may be seated, everybody. Shabbat Shalom. Yes, Shabbat Shalom. It seems like summer is upon us, yes? Oh, good, good. Well, I thought that today, you know, in our circle setup, we like to do a little study. We could just look at our Besorah passage, a phenomenal passage. Today, I want to look specifically at Yochanan 12. So if you have a Torah Bible with the Besorah in it, open it up if you can. If not, you can go grab one out there if you'd like to follow along. I'll also read it here. So, and I'd like to look at the first part here, 1 through 11, where Miriam anoints Yeshua with the oil, and just walk through this and see what we can glean from this passage today. So we just read this, and we have 6 days before Pesach. Oh, and if you have a comment, raise your hand and we'll use the mics so that the Zoom folks can hear you. So Yeshua, 6 days after, before Passover, so this is Yeshua's third Pesach that he's coming into Jerusalem that we've heard about in the Besorot. Yeshua comes to Bethany with his disciples, and there Lazarus, or Eleazar in Hebrew, remember in chapter 11, and right before, Yeshua just raised Lazarus from the dead. An amazing miracle that caused all kinds of controversy. And then they prepared a dinner. They prepared a meal for Yeshua. And Martha is there, and she's serving. And Eleazar, or Lazarus, was one of those reclining on the table. See if you can sort of visualize this scene here. And Miriam takes a pound of this very expensive oil of pure nard and anoints Yeshua's feet and wipes his feet with her hair and dries the remaining oil. And it's really a remarkable scene. We're going to unpack that a little bit here. Now, there are six different Miriams that are possibly mentioned in the Besorah, five or six, depending upon whether you think one is the same person or not. And sometimes this Miriam here is confused with Luke 7, the woman who comes up when Yeshua is at the Pharisee's house and basically wipes his feet with her tears. Cries all over him and then wipes her hair, uses her hair to wipe her tears. That didn't come out right. And we sort of think that's likely a totally different person, and that person isn't named. And it's not the Miriam that was freed from seven demons. That's a different Miriam. This is Miriam, the sister of Martha and of Lazarus. So now the story is also told in Matthew and Mark. It's told a little bit different. Miriam isn't mentioned by name. It's a woman. And they're at the house of Simon HaMetzorah, Shimon the leper. And so I don't think it's a contradiction. I think it's just that if you imagine Bethany was a space, and you know that Yeshua and his disciples are coming in and they want to host the dinner, and Lazarus might say, well, we don't have enough room to fit everybody, but Shimon, he's got a big place. Maybe he'll do it, and he hosts the dinner. And Lazarus is there, Miriam and Martha are there, and they're all neighbors. I think that's what's going on here. And Shimon the leper, that doesn't mean that he was a leper necessarily. Otherwise, I don't think he'd be hosting. But probably he was a leper who was healed. We don't know, but that's my guess, is that Yeshua had healed him. And yeah, maybe the house was empty. He was coming back in and, who knows? But he maybe kept that name, obviously kept that name. That was how they identified. He was the leper who was healed. I think that's very likely. So he's hosting this dinner and the disciples are there. There's probably other people there too that aren't mentioned. Let's look at Miriam and Martha first, and just sort of unpack their character a bit. Where else do we see Miriam and Martha interacting together? There's two other places. Yeah, go ahead. Miriam and Martha, yeah. Yeah. Yes. Yeah, you guys remember this passage. It's in Luke 10. And so what happens here is Yeshua visits their home, and Martha is busy serving and, taking care of everyone and doing those things. And Miriam is just there, like, at Yeshua's feet learning and hearing from him. And Martha gets frustrated. And you can understand, it's very real situation. Martha gets frustrated that Miriam isn't helping. She asks Yeshua to intervene. Yeshua, you know, it's fascinating. I don't think Yeshua was like against Martha. I don't think Martha was bad. That's not it at all. But he gently corrects Martha and saying that, hey, look, you're worried and you're distracted about a lot of things, but Miriam is doing something that's important. He says she's chosen the right thing here, and learning from him is what's most important. So we have this two different characters here. And then there's another time. We just read it in the last chapter. Miriam and Martha, yeah?
Well, they go out to meet Yeshua.
Yes,
they go out to meet Yeshua when he's on his way to raise Lazarus from the dead. They don't know what he's going to do.
Yeah.
So in their heart sickness, they say, if you'd only been here earlier, you would have prevented this sorrow.
Yes.
And they each accost him in the same kind of way.
Right.
And Yeshua's answer to each one of them is a little bit different.
Right. And their response to Yeshua is a little bit different. Let's look at that for a moment, because I think that picks up on some character qualities. That's really great. So Martha goes out first. Now, he didn't even get to the town. Martha went out before he even got to the town. So it isn't that Martha doesn't have any devotion. You know, her devotion was just service. Don't look at Martha negatively, I think. She goes out and meets him before he gets into the town. And she says, listen, if you'd been here, my brother wouldn't be dead. But then she adds something. She says, but I know that even now, whatever you ask of God, he'll give of you. And Yeshua says, your brother will rise again. And she says, I know, he'll rise at the resurrection. That's not good enough. She doesn't say it, but the implication is that's not good enough, you know. And then Yeshua makes this profound theological, you know, declaration. I am the resurrection and the life. Whoever believes in me, even if he dies, shall live. And whoever lives and believes in me shall never die. Do you believe this? And Martha responds, yes, Lord, I believe you are the Messiah, Ben Elohim, the Son of God, who has come into the world. So then Martha goes and gets her sister and says, the master's here, go out secretly. And Miriam goes out and meets Yeshua. And Miriam says exactly the same thing. If you had been here, my brother wouldn't have died. But then something different happens. She weeps, and Yeshua weeps with her. You see, it's a different interaction that he has with her. And then he, you know, goes to the tomb, and he calls Lazarus by name, and Lazarus comes out after 4 days. So there's a difference. What are some of the differences in personality between Martha and Miriam that you can see in the text? Personality differences. What? Yeah. Oh.
Martha is a doer, and she's very aware of circumstances and what would make people more comfortable or fulfill their needs, and so she's very attentive as a service. She's a service-oriented person.
Yes, action-oriented, service-oriented. Yeah, yeah. She's sort of maybe a pragmatic person. Mm-hmm. Yep. She demonstrates great faith, you know, and theological understanding. I mean, you know, she's very devoted, but it's a pragmatic, action-oriented devotion. What about Miriam? How is Miriam a little bit different? I see someone over here. Cheryl.
Well, it seems like Miriam both times is like in the process with Yeshua, like down in it with Yeshua, listening and at his side and weeping. And so there's that connection there. But it also does seem that you have to have two sides of the story. It's so easy. Like I kind of was always taught, oh, well, of course you want to be the one sitting at his feet and not running around. But yet he raised Lazarus because Martha pushed it.
Mm-hmm.
She said, I know that what the Father says to you. And Miriam actually didn't do that. So it's like both of it makes like a full picture.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's really interesting. Yeah, yeah. Rob, did you have a...
I was just going to say that Martha leads with Adam. And rather, Miriam leads with Adam. She responds to Yeshua and quickly cries. Or she's at his feet and she bathes him with Bernard.
Right.
You know. But Martha is much more, as it were, pragmatic. Calculating, perhaps, and service-oriented.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's right. Yeah, Miriam is leading emotionally. Just think about this question for a moment. I don't know if any of you have a thought, but or just think about it. Which are you more like? And I think, guys, we can sort of, we might have some similarities to these things. Are you more this Miriam character or this more this Martha character? And it's not a better or worse. I really don't think it's a better or worse thing. I think either character can go in extremes and, you know, it needs to be kind of brought back, you know, and needs each other. But it's interesting to think about how do we serve God? Are we serving, you know, one way or the other? Again, the tradition, the like, sort of Christian tradition has been that Martha is like bad. If you're a Martha, you're bad, you know. But I don't think it's that way at all. Yeah.
Probably for many of us, we identify with both Miriam and Martha in different seasons of our lives, in different like spheres of our lives. So I think all of us, well, at least myself, I identify with both for different reasons.
Jesse, I think that's true.
I completely agree with what you said. I think that we can be both. We can be one more Martha and more Miriam at times, but can't we also be both, where you are serving out of emotion, you're serving out of love, you may be doing things that in non-emotional times you would never do, or you may be emotional in times when you normally would be very pragmatic. So I think they're not either one or the other mutually exclusive. They can blend as well.
Yes, that's right.
The same Yeshua, you know, who set his face like a flint toward Jerusalem, and you know, came into the synagogue or the temple, I should say, and with you know the scourge and overturned all the tables and got angry at everything. He's also the same one that wept over Jerusalem. You know, I long to gather you like a mother hen gathers her chicks, and you know, who wept when Lazarus died. So I mean, it's a perfect example.
Yeah. I think that's wonderful. I think the reason why we sort of, there's this assumption of Martha is not good is because of Yeshua's correction of her. But I wonder if that was motivated by Martha's criticism of Miriam. Not necessarily because of her service and her orientation, but because of the sort of resentment that she wasn't allowing Miriam to be who she needed to be at that time. I wonder. Tyson.
I think some of the interpretation we have of that passage has come when we remember that the folks that wrote that, we're still in the delusion of the world was ending soon. So they were in this, it was flavor. Everything that is in those scriptures is flavored with the idea of, we don't have time, the world is ending, we need to absorb and do. So I think if you take that into account, it softens some of the stuff that we felt for years over that passage.
Interesting. Like because the days are numbered, you got to just sit at Yeshua's feet, you know?
They were selling their possessions. They were getting ready. They were getting ready for the end of the world. They totally misinterpreted what was going on. And that flavor falls into all those writings. And we need to look at it from 2,000 years later and take that out of it.
Yes.
And sometimes
I think
we
that's
fail
true.
That.
Right. Because then adding in, you know, other Torah values and or even like, but Paul talks all the time about hospitality, about serving, different gifts that we have, administrative gifts. I mean, he, you know, read just Corinthians, for example, talks all about these kinds of things, you know, without like saying one's better than the other. And the things that Martha had are things that are celebrated in the Torah and celebrated in Jewish tradition and in the Besorah and the letters. I think that's right. And we have to find this balance because there's a sense of which, you know, he's coming soon and you know, come like a thief in the night, you know, and we all should sort of live in this expectation of, you know, the world this coming soon, but at the same time recognize that you know, soon is very relative, and you know, we could be, you know, another 1,000 years out, and and we still have to build the world. I love the rabbinic phrase, you know, there's a guy planting a tree, and someone comes and says, hey, the Messiah's here, you know, and he says, well, let me finish planting the tree and then I'll go meet him. And the idea is that planting the tree is the work of Messiah, and that's what we want to be doing, is the work of Messiah when he returns. We don't want to be reacting in all these other ways. We should be tending to the world. Connie, okay, thank you, Chaim.
I just was going to tell something funny that happened.
Yeah.
I have a lot of sisters. We were all at my mother's home, and they were all making the lunch. I was in the dining room reading my Bible, and they got very angry at me because I wasn't helping. So I did quote this, that it didn't make them very happy, but I did quote.
I'm sure it didn't.
We made Miriam's and Martha's. So.
I love that. I love that. Yeah, that's right. That's right. Yeah, that's good. That's good. Deep tea, and then we can go on.
I was going to say Martha always ends up getting a bad rap, but yeah. She's always concerned about other people,
yeah.
Which is nice because yeah. That's Hesed, that's the loving kindness. And I also think, like, you know, in my culture, we say, like, every sibling is different. Like, you have five fingers, but they all look different from each other, but that's it's part of one piece.
Yeah.
And I also was thinking about Cain and Abel and how, like, God was talking to both of them in different ways because he loved both of them. Mm-hmm. And he says to Cain, like, if you do what is right, will it not be accepted? Right? Yeah. So Yeshua, I see speaking to Mary and Martha the same way.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. The uniqueness. Yeah. There's something about the uniqueness and honoring our unique identity. Stacey, you got to come. Yeah, go ahead, Stacey, and then we'll move on to the oil.
Just a quick one, but if you're in the business that I have been in and Tyson is in, you're kind of both Mary and Martha at the same time because, you know, you're out there doing what you have to do. You don't have a lot of time to think, but inside you're praying, oh, God, please don't let there be a backdraft.
Yeah, you're doing both at the same time. That's right. Firefighting business for those. Yeah. That's good. That's good. Okay, let's take a close look at what Miriam did. So a Roman pound, a pound of this nard oil, was 12 ounces. And so that's roughly the amount of oil that we'd find in a soda can. So think about it like that, about 12 ounces. And the perfume that she used was called pure nard, which is also known as spikenard. It's an oil derived from a rare plant in the mountains of today of India and Nepal. And it had to be hand extracted from the root and then carried, you know, I'm blanking on the name of the road, but there was a road that went through that was very difficult to travel by that became much more popular after Marco Polo. The Silk Road, that's right, yeah. And so, but it was still accessible in the first century and very difficult to bring over. Now, typically this would be diluted, but here it makes a note that it was pure, and so that adds. That we're adding to the story here, and if you can think of the scent of what this would be, I had to look this up to see what because I have no idea, but according to folks, this is earthy and mossy. Has anyone smelled this before?
Very strong.
Oh, you have. Wow. Okay, very strong. Is this right? Wet. Just the nard. What about wet soil on a forest floor? No. Okay, what do you think? Yeah, it's not earthy. Okay. It's very, it's like hard to describe is what I was reading. Like it's, because it's so like, it's so unique. It's so sort of sacred seeming. Yeah, that's cool. I'd love to smell that. Now the jar is made of alabaster stone and they in the first century, we've actually found jars, and they would have a long neck. And so when she broke it, it wasn't that she broke smashed it, but she would have broken off the top so that she could pour it out. But according to what most people think, it wasn't resealable. I don't think we know that for sure. It could have just been breaking the seal off, but you know, it seems like once you break it, you've sort of broken it. But the children's Bibles show it like smashing, and that's probably not what she did. Okay, so it's like a one-time thing. Now, Judas objects, and he says that, listen, this could have been sold for 300 denarii. And Matthew 20 tells us that a day labor was about, a denarii per day was a day wage. So we're talking a lot of money. We're talking 300 days of labor. And if we put that into, I know these calculations are wildly inaccurate, but if we put this into like today's labor costs, imagine a laborer in this area makes 120 a day maybe. you know, just for doing the work on the ground. And so that's about $36,000 poured out, you know, right then in today's world. So again, we don't know exactly what that would have been in their economic world, but the idea is this is not just like, you know, it's not just like an expensive thing. This is like a ridiculously expensive thing, you know. So imagine this scene, and Yeshua is reclining with his disciples, with Eleazar. They're still, I would imagine, surrounded by the joy of the resurrection. We don't know how many days after the resurrection Yeshua had left and come back. Passover 6 days away. You can imagine that they're thinking all about cleaning out their chametz. And, you know, there's lots of preparations and things that are going on for Pesach. Martha's serving again, doing her thing. And, you know, it seems very positive in this passage. Maybe she's wondering where her sister's gone, you know, like Miriam again, where are you? I still need help, maybe. But then Miriam appears and she's carrying their family treasure. We don't know where she got this. You know, you think about it. We also don't know where their parents were. Three siblings, where were their parents? Maybe this was like an heirloom, you know, probably. It could have been something that they would have kept around as like their inheritance, you know? And then Yochanan says that she anointed his feet. Matthew and Mark say that she anointed his head. And so I like to put these together. They report different parts, and I can imagine, especially with 12 ounces, that she would have started at his head and then moved and anointed his feet and anointed both. And Yochanan is emphasizing the feet because of the humility, and then he's, in the next chapter, going to go into Yeshua washing his disciples' feet, and so he's thinking feet. He's connecting the lines here when he's writing his Besorah. So this is just a deeply personal act. She wipes his feet with her hair. So what would you be feeling watching this experience? Like you're one of those, the people at the table just watching. What are you going to be thinking? What are you going to be feeling? What's that? Surprised? Yeah. Yeah, surprised. Mm-hmm. Shocked? Yeah, I think I would be. Would any of you be kind of be like, that's really expensive. What are you doing? Yeah, sure. Especially the financially oriented people here, right? You know? human thing, sure. Yeah. Impulsive? Yeah. Uh-huh. Maybe not thought out, you know? Yeah. Cheryl? The level of intimacy would make you feel uncomfortable. Yeah, I think that's probably right. We'd probably feel a bit uncomfortable, not sure what to do with this. Yeah. She understood what was most important. Yeah. Right. Yeah, she knew something intuitively. Yeah, yeah, filling the whole room. And smells make memories. I mean, smells are like, you know, they change your whole perception of everything. I see Fred.
Just being me, I wouldn't have felt uncomfortable.
Yeah.
Seeing her do that, I would have felt, you know, someone I know, Yeshua is so special to all of us. It seems very human.
Yeah.
And the alabaster jar, even thousands of years before, alabaster was a highly thought of container in Egypt. You can even go to the Museum of Fine Arts and see alabaster jars.
Yeah.
But not to jump ahead, but maybe for further discussion another time, why in the world did Yeshua keep Judah around knowing he was a thief? And especially, it occurred to my mind that he's one of the apostles.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, what is this man doing being an apostle? But this maybe for another, but I couldn't help but share that thought.
Great question. Maybe that's another topic would be how much of Yeshua knew what he was doing and how much of it was sort of this prophetic, like needing to, you know, Yeshua needed to be betrayed in some way. So there's this story and this unfolding of the story and how much of it is sort of allowed to happen and how much happens behind the scenes. big questions, great questions. Nick? Oh, Cheryl. Cheryl, you have...
I just quickly was thinking, like, the community-wise, like, this is a Jewish community.
Yeah.
You know, we are right. Messianic Jewish community. Like, we hug sideways. We observe a certain level of modesty that's, like, a norm in our community.
Right.
So that, I guess, just thinking about that breaking of convention and putting Yeshua first so much may have made people uncomfortable, but I'm having this thought of a foreshadowing of Yeshua, hanging naked at that level of intimacy in his love for us. And I don't know, I've just never thought of it that way before, that almost like a foreshadowing of breaking convention for this like ultimate like love and intimacy, even beyond what is considered good and a norm and important in a community.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But just having the most important be the most important.
Yeah, it was definitely a vulnerable moment,
yeah.
For sure.
Yeah, but he's going to be doing that too.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. This is sort of following the track of what's going to happen in the future. That's what maybe why the foot washing is next in the story. Nick?
Maybe she, unlike basically everybody else, got it, that he was going to die.
She might have been the only one who got it. Yeah.
Yeah, and that's really kind of surprising.
Yeah.
I mean, they're at the, you know, in John 14, they're scared to death. They finally figured it out.
Yeah.
But that's a week away.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, that's great. Raina mentioned that, we were talking about this last night, she mentioned that idea. I hadn't thought of it. You know, Miriam sat at his feet. She might have even been listening more than anyone else. And Yeshua did say, you know, that he was going to die. And the disciples really pushed it away and didn't want to believe it and didn't try to understand it, as far as we know. But maybe she really got it. You know. Also, think about this. I mean, Lazarus was just resurrected from the dead. I mean, like, you know, that's going to change the whole color of the room, the whole atmosphere of the room. You know, where all of a sudden, like, Yeshua is not just the guy who did miracles. I mean, like, 4 days dead in the tomb, and that was their brother. I mean, you can just imagine how you would feel about him being there. You would do anything, you know? I mean, it does sort of change the tenor of the room. But yes.
You asked how I would react, and maybe I'm a little strange, but to add to what Cheryl said, what Mary did, she had to be so vulnerable to do this. And I would, the first question I've asked myself, could I do this? Could I humble myself this much?
Yes.
You know, me and my buddies here have been with Yeshua for 3 years, and none of us have ever done anything like this. I'm not sure I could do it.
Yeah, it's a great question. Great question. And actually, that leads to my next point, which is that Matthew and Mark, they don't say Judas had this comment. They say that some people at the table had this comment. And the same idea, like, we could sell this for and give it to the poor. Whereas Yochanan highlights Yehuda saying this, and then qualifies it by saying, well, but he didn't really care about the poor. He was actually stealing from the money. So I wonder if Yochanan was a little bitter towards Yehuda, you know, but I wonder if you put the two stories together, it might have been that Yehuda initiated this conversation, but that others kind of felt the same way. And it was like a little bit of a discussion and an argument at the table. Like, what are we doing? Like, what is he doing? You know, and they're all talking about it together. It's probably very realistic. And I think realistically, we'd probably all be in that mix of, you know, in this room here, we'd be a mix of, that was a waste. We could use this for something else. We could, you know... You know what I mean? We could buy a house. We could give to the poor. And then others who would be like it in the emotional space. And maybe that's part of the drama of it, you know? Yeah. Rob?
I don't know. It's not a good position to be joining Judas Iscariot on anything. I mean, that's for sure.
You're probably right.
But I think as you reflect on the value of this alabaster container of nard, and you think about the intense smell and the fact that it intrudes into this whole experience, something Miriam did something that changed, as you said, you know, there was a color change in the room just because Lazarus was there. Well, now there's yet another color, and
yeah.
Everybody has to experience what Miriam did. I'm still struck by feeling that this was impulsive, this was not well thought out, and I also, the contrast between Marta doing something very good for all the people there, yeah, and not being able to partake in this, and not only that, losing perhaps some of her inheritance with this impulsive act,
right,
by Miriam. I'm really hoping that you're going to be able to resolve this passage in a way that I'm going to come out of this feeling a little better about the whole thing, because I'm kind of upset with Yeshua that he just sort of accepted this and enjoyed it. You know, this was a lot. So
yeah,
anyway, that's where I am.
Yeah, it's another voice. Well, Yeshua resolves it in the next verse. I don't know if it's satisfactory, but he resolves it this way. He says, therefore, Yeshua said, leave her alone. She set it aside for the day of my burial. You will always have the poor among you, but you will not always have me. So there's two ways of reading this, and if you look at different translations, there's two different options. One hints that let her save the rest for my burial, like implying, you know, that, you know, leave her alone. You know, she's going to use this for my burial in the future. And then the other, which I think is more accurate, not because of the language, but because of the sense of the story, that she has prepared this as this is a prophetic event. She's actually anointing me for my burial right now. And so what he does is he takes it out of the realm of practicality entirely and moves it into this pragmatic space where maybe she probably is being, you know, impromptu, but maybe it's a prophetic move, or at least Yeshua sees it that way. And what she's doing is she's actually anointing him for his burial, and it becomes a much bigger experience. And consider like Nicodemus using 100 pounds of myrrh and frankincense, you know, for his burial. Later on, that was, you know, extravagant. And so there's this act, he sees it as an act of worship that seems to trump these other practical things. You know, in yeah. You know how in conversations, if you don't understand the perspective of the other, it seems different? But what if Miriam really knew and she understood he was going into Jerusalem to die? But maybe the others didn't, you know, and so her coming in and doing this has, you know, and they would say, what are you doing? She's like, you don't understand, you know, you'll understand later. Yeah. Sure, insights from the street, yeah.
They could have maybe insight in that circle that they were moving with Yeshua of the spirit revealing some things, or even having some visions or something that, you know, you see in advance, or
yes,
you know, some kind of insight. Yeah. So when they imagine seeing that, or imagine that, you know, seeing the death before it happened, so, I mean, it's extremely emotional. So that's maybe why an action of intuitive action of buying this perfume, and because you have seen that, you may experience beforehand an,
yes,
action like that.
That's exact. I think that's exactly right. And there's another incident. Remember when the high priest in Acts, you know, makes this, the high priest makes this comment about, one should die. Yeah, exactly. That's right. It's not an act. And he basically says, you know, he's like predicting his death, but he's not, he doesn't know it. So there is that thread that happens in the Besorah.
Yeah. I also just think that in the light of like life and death and being in this experience of Lazarus actually died, then Lazarus was alive again. I mean, to be in the presence of a close person who has died,
right, right,
nothing is the same. The right. Monetary value has no value whatsoever.
It has no value. Life
in the light of life and death. And to see this Messiah that brings life and is talking about his own death, I just think in the context of that life and death, the cost of that nard probably was just completely irrelevant.
Yeah, could be. It could be. Deb, and then I'm going to close with one last final kind of question thought, because I know we're late.
A lot of these things I also think as well. But, you know, Marta and Miriam were there when Yeshua gave them back their family and their future, as Lazarus was, you know, the man, the provider,
yeah,
of the whole family.
Right.
So for them, right, their whole world was upside down with him passing. And Yeshua gave everything back to them, you know, a good future for them, a blessing. And why, you know, if everything was gone from their life, you know, therefore, can't she not give everything of hers to him and that not only blessing, as you said, that you believe that he knew he was coming, but it's all she had. She gave all in thanksgiving and praise to him.
Yeah, she gave, that's a great segue. She gave everything. No, that's really it. She gave everything. And so I wonder, you know, this act of honoring Yeshua with the most precious treasure that you have kind of invites us to ask ourselves the same question. I think, Harry, you kind of asked it. You know, but going beyond oil, what's in your jar that you would bring to Yeshua? What's inside of your jar? So if you imagine Miriam's jar, not only as the family inheritance, but as a symbol of anything that's deeply valuable, even beyond money, what is your most precious treasure in your life? And have you surrendered it to Yeshua? I mean, because that's what she did. And I don't think it means that you have to, like, break the jar and lose the dream necessarily. I think circumstances are different. But are you willing to surrender? Are we willing to surrender these things? I'll say we because, you know, same question. Are we willing to surrender these things? And what are you holding tightly to in your own jar of treasure? Think of hopes. Think of dreams. Think of, loves. You know, think of those things. And Yeshua says, I'll just paraphrase. He says, listen, whatever you give up for me and lists a bunch of stuff, I'll give back to you in this age, meaning in this world, 100-fold. And then even more life, eternal life, is what he says. So, I know I could list a bunch of different things that I would be very, whether it's, family and children. And, important things that, kids, And those of you with grown children, you've got to release them to Yeshua and surrender, but these are deep things to think about. So maybe we'll leave with just think about something like that in your life that maybe Yeshua might be asking you to surrender. And again, when we surrender these things, we let him do his thing and we trust him with it. And we let him make even more of it sometimes. And if not, it's giving up something. He'll replace it with something even better in our lives. So let us surrender our hearts to him, just like Miriam. So thank you, everyone. Forgive me for going a bit over. Why don't we close our service with the Aleinu on page 93.
And the descendants of your people Israel be those who know your name and study your Torah for Messiah.